All right, let's sit up nice and comfortably tall. Eyes closed. We begin by reciting Om three times. Let's take a deep inhalation. Now, softly. So, namaste, and once again, thank you all very much for giving me this opportunity to be together and share some information about the Gita. And like you said, you already have studied some, so please feel free to ask questions as we go along. I'll do my best. Okay. This is roughly, now you all have a copy of the presentation? Mm-hmm. Not here though.
Yeah, I got on my phone, but I can look at the preview.
That's fine, you don't need it. Yeah,
we got it. We have the electronic copy.
Yeah, you have the electronic copy. That's good. That's all that matters, right? Okay, so this is roughly the outline of the session. Start with some background information, like a little bit of a historical perspective to what are the different events that brought us to this war, you know, Kurukshetra war as it's called. And then we'll turn our attention to the main theme of Gita, which is the collection of four paths to yoga, as it is said here. So we'll talk about these four paths of yoga: karma yoga, bhakti, jnana, and dhyana yoga. And I'm sure you've heard these terms. You're familiar with these terms? Okay. So we'll kind of go through those statements or those verses in the Gita which represent these kinds of thoughts.
Can I ask a question already?
Yes.
There's four listed here, but when I looked in the book, there's the yoga of, you know, three qualities of nature, and other ones also, you know, through the chapters. So there seems like there's more than four, and I'm just wondering.
What are the other more than four?
Well, so like yoga of divine manifestation, for example, is that one? Is that like bhakti, for example?
Yes.
Bhakti, okay. So they're organized into subgroups, I would guess.
Well, every chapter in this Gita. Mm-hmm. Is the title of each chapter ends with yoga. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean there are 18 styles of yoga. Okay, there are 18 chapters. Each chapter ends with the word yoga. Okay, it just yoga just means way of life, so to say, it's the philosophy, you can call it, understanding. Yoga means a lot of different things depending on the context. Okay. But when we say ways of, you know, approaching yoga, those are four broad categories which are these listed here. Okay? All right, so. And then we also will briefly talk about the three gunas, you know, sattva, rajas, and tamas. We talked about these during our sutra introduction also. You know, they are very important. Because once you start reading the Gita, you will notice that starting with chapter 14, I would say it's almost entirely devoted to the gunas, and then you know, there are sprinkling of gunas in the remaining chapters. But of course, it starts right from the very beginning. We talk about gunas. Okay. Then there are a few other verses of Gita which I couldn't fit into these four styles of bhakti or into these four categories of yoga, so I've listed them under other significant verses of Gita. You know, it's a hard thing to pick significant verses because there are 700 of them, and depending on who you listen to, they all will give you a different perspective on which for them is most significant. Okay, so this is entirely based on my own preference, so to say, my own understanding and preference, because I've also been studying the Gita for almost 15, 16 years now, and I have picked those verses that I think are more significant. So, and they may not match if you look, you know, if you listen to somebody else or if you read somebody else's text, you know, they might give you a different list. Okay, then I've mentioned Q&A at the end, but feel free to ask questions anytime. Okay. So, let's start with a very basic introduction to the concepts. Now, as you know, Gita is a small chapter in this whole epic called Mahabharata. Have you all heard that? Mm-hmm. You familiar with that?
Heard it. Not that familiar.
Hmm?
Heard it. Wouldn't sound familiar with it.
Okay. But there's a chapter. It's a small chapter. There are 700 verses in the Gita. And in the Mahabharata itself, the whole epic, the entire poem, the entire story, anybody guess how many verses are there in that whole?
We're guessing.
Guess.
50.
No. There's 700 in the Gita.
Yeah.
Okay. In the entire Mahabharata, there has to be more than 700, right?
Oh, I see. Okay. 12,000.
12,000.
I'll go with 7,000.
Okay. There are 100,000 verses in that Mahabharata. It's one of the probably the longest poem in the entire world. Okay? And it's a story. It's at some, you know, in some sense it almost is like a soap opera story. But the underlying philosophy is so deep and it's so significant, so meaningful, that the entire framework of the Indian society is built on these two epics. You know, I'm going to talk about the other one also very briefly. So the underlying concepts, even though the surface story may seem like a soap opera with everyone giving into all kinds of emotions, feelings and behavior patterns and everything, the underlying concepts are so deep, so spiritually aligned, that the whole fabric of Indian society is kind of based on these stories. Everyone reveres these stories. Okay? So we in India, when we grow up, we always are listening to these stories in some form or the other. Okay? So Mahabharata is a huge, big story with lots and lots of characters and many stories and sub-stories, subplots, within plots, you know, all kinds of stuff, as you can imagine. It's a huge text. The other very important epic is Ramayana. Ramayana is another story. That's the story of Lord Rama, as they call him. Have you heard the name Rama? In what connection? I mean, in this.
I know Rama is a god, but I don't know exactly the details.
Right. Okay. So Rama is. He was a character in that story, Ramayana. But then, subsequently, he has been revered now as a god, as one of the incarnations of Supreme Godhead and all that. So, you know, a lot of people worship him, just like a lot of people worship Krishna. Okay, Krishna, who is a main character in the Gita, one of the characters in Gita. Okay, so similarly, Rama and his wife Sita, you know, in Ramayana, they're also revered and worshipped as divine personalities, so to say. So Gita is a part of Mahabharata, as I mentioned here, and it's a very ancient story. There is no real agreement on what the date is, how old it is, but anywhere from 3000 to older, that's how old these stories are. Okay. Now, to understand the content of Gita, you have to understand the even, you know, further back as to where it is, where the origins are of these concepts and all these philosophies. And we go back to the Vedas. Have you heard the term Vedas? What's the Veda?
Knowledge.
Veda is knowledge, but when we talk about the text Veda,
ancient, like, text, or the oldest?
The oldest texts, the oldest scriptures, you can call them oldest texts. And they are the sort of the container of the ultimate truth and ultimate reality. And they, once you know them, you know everything about life and death and everything else. Okay. So there are four Vedas, four of them. Do you remember the names? You have them. Okay. All right. So there's Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Atharva Veda. So the four Vedas. The oldest and the largest among these is the Rig Veda. Okay. And that is, it's very large. Again, several verses in that. And each Veda has two main segments and four kind of divisions in each Veda. The two major categories of divisions are, the first part of the Veda, of each of these four Vedas, first part, it's called, in Sanskrit it's called the Karma Kanda, which is the ritualistic part of the text, ritualistic. And the second is the knowledge part. So they have kind of divided each Veda into the ritualistic part and the knowledge part. What does that mean? In the ritualistic part, there are procedures and rituals mentioned for attaining certain end goals and results. There are rituals, you know, that you can perform if you are a farmer and you don't get, you don't have enough rain, so to kind of increase the possibility of having rain, you perform a certain ritual. All right. And if you are a poor person and you really want some wealth, in those days wealth was what? Cows and animals, you know, that was the wealth. So if you want 100 cows, you will have to perform a certain ritual, you know. Or if you're not married, if you want a good wife in marriage, you will perform a certain ritual. So all kinds of rituals at the spiritual level, at the materialistic level, at the family and household level, they were all prescribed in the Vedas. That's the first part. But again, the underlying concepts and the philosophical understream was all very spiritually based. And that was reflected in the second part of the Vedas called the Jnana Kanda, or the knowledge part of the Vedas. And the fourth section in the Vedas, that came to be known as Upanishads. Have you heard the term Upanishad? Are you familiar with any?
Well, I guess the Gita is from the Upanishad, right?
You say that again?
Isn't the Gita from the Upanishads? No.
It's not from the Upanishad.
In the Gita, right? Hmm? The Upanishads are in the Gita.
The essence of the Upanishads is in the Gita. Essence. Okay, it's not a part of the Upanishads, no. The essential message from the Upanishads was a part of Gita. Of course, there are much more to Gita Because Upanishads are mostly philosophical in nature. Gita is very practical in nature. Gita tells you how to lead your life. Gita tells you what to do in your day-to-day thinking, day-to-day life, how to lead your life so that you can attain the eventual goal of life, which is self-realization and all that stuff. So Gita, just like the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, you know, even though it's derived from the Sankhya philosophy, but the Yoga Sutras are much more than philosophy. It's a pure practical guide to life. Similarly, Gita, even though it is kind of based on the philosophy of the Upanishads, but it is much more of a guide to life. Okay, so that's the distinction between the pure philosophy and the Gita.
So you say the Gita is based on the Upanishads?
It contains the essential message. It's not. We cannot say it is based on the Upanishads, but it contains the essential message of the Upanishads. Does that make a difference? Clear?
It does.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what the statement I made here is: the Gita contains the quintessential essence of philosophy. And then, of course, much more than that, because like I said, it's a guide to living life meaningfully or to fulfillment. Okay. And many people think of it as an extension of Upanishads, you know, just because it is so meaningful. I mean, it's not a part of Upanishads, but it's revered as a scripture in its own right. You know, when you go to a court, right, in this country, when you go to a court, you're supposed to put your hand on the Bible and then say, you know, I swear, whatever, you know, the whole truth and all that. In India, when you go to a court, you put your hand on a Gita. That's universal. That's been accepted in our... it's a part of the culture, basically. So you will put your hand on the Gita and then say, I swear that whatever I'm going to say is the truth and the whole truth, etc. So Gita is revered in that sense. Okay. So Gita itself has 18 chapters, okay, and 700 verses. Okay. Some chapters are smaller number of verses. Some are very large. Okay. Chapter 2 and 18 are the largest, upwards of 70 verses in each chapter, etc., etc. So there are many different. Now, what does Gita contain? It contains the teachings given by Lord Krishna to the warrior prince Arjuna. You all know that, right? Arjuna and Krishna, these names are familiar. Okay. Now, Krishna was himself a king, you all know that. He had a very large army. He was also a very close friend of Arjuna and blood. He was also a first cousin to these people. So they were all very closely related also. Yeah. This is, you know, we always say that the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, they transcend time. That means they are not limited by time. They have been around for thousands of years and they are as meaningful, valuable, useful today as they were whenever they were written. Nothing changes. Very, very, very important in that sense. And it's a practical, self-contained guide to life. Guide to life, how to live your life meaningfully and eventually attain your final goal of life, which is self-realization. How to realize your true essence of your being. Okay? That's what it's all about. And it's written in a very poetic form, and usually it is chanted. Okay, so... When we study Gita, we first chant the shlokas and all that. So Let me see if I can find something that I can chant for you. This is not from Gita. This is from the meditation on Gita, but the meter is the same. So I can, you know, I can just to give you. I forgot to bring my. Well, let me get this book.
It doesn't have the Sanskrit.
It doesn't have the Sanskrit.
No, I don't believe. I didn't see any in there at all.
Okay. Oh, I see. Let me see. Hold on a second. Okay, there's one I have. This is the very first verse in the Gita. I'm going to just kind of sing it just the way it is recited most often. There are multiple people who have sung it in many different ways. You know, as long as the meter is maintained, you can sing it in any tune that you want. Okay, but this is the most commonly way to recite this. So it is recited as Dharmakshetre Kurukshetre Samaveta Yuyutsavaha Mamaka Pandavaschaiva Kimakuravata Sanjaya. Okay, so that's how it is. And you keep doing the same thing over and over again into the, you know, the whole, once you're done with the whole thing. Okay? Now, this particular meter that I sang in, it's the name of this meter is Anushtup Chanda. Chanda means a meter. Anushtup is the name. Okay? And the characteristics of this chanda, of this meter, are very specifically mentioned. Okay? And every verse has to follow these rules very critically. You cannot have any violation in the rules to be able to comply with the rules of this chanda, of this meter. So each verse has four quarters. So every verse has four quarters, four segments. And sixth syllable will be a long syllable. Fifth syllable is a short syllable. Then in the first and third quarter, seventh syllable is long. And in the second and fourth quarter, seventh syllable is short. Now, these are very strict guidelines and there are rules. Remember, in the entire Mahabharata, there are 100,000 verses. Out of those 100,000, about 85 to 90% are in this meter. There are a few which are in a second meter called Trishtup Chanda, Trishtup, Anushtup, Trishtup, all right? So you can imagine all these 100,000 verses, they follow these rules absolutely. You cannot find any violation in these rules. None at all. So in this one, the one that we just sang, so Dharma Kshetre, Kuru Kshetre, that's one quarter. Samaveta, Yujusubaha, that's the second quarter, etc. So there are four quarters. And then you look at the first quarter, the seventh syllable has to be large, long, and there are definitions of what long and short mean. Okay, you have to follow those very, very rigid rules. All right. So that's as far as this meter goes. Now, coming back to the bit of the historical perspective on what exactly led to this war. Okay, so the war was, it took place in a field called, anybody, you remember the field name? Kurukshetra. Have you heard the term? Kurukshetra? Look at the meaning of the very first verse in chapter 1. first verse.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me, Sanjay, what do my sons and how do sons do when they stumble on the holy field of Kurukshetra?
That's what I've said. Kurukshetra.
Kurukshetra. Eager to fight.
Right. That's the name of the field. So that's why it is called the War of Kurukshetra. Kurukshetra. Kshetra means field. Kuru is the name of this clan or dynasty. Okay. So the name of the field itself is Kurukshetra. Alright? That's the name of the war itself is Kurukshetra. It's either called Kurukshetra War or the War of Mahabharata. That's it. Standard. Alright? And like I said, it's a very huge story involving thousands of characters and situations and events, and it goes back many generations. That's the starting point, is, you know, several generations ago, you know, compared to these people.
So the story is rooted in history, is that true, or is it?
Again, people who are believers, they believe it's rooted in history. They claim that it's impossible to come up with so many characters with very specific names of locations which are exactly there in India right now. Okay, so it probably was true, but there are some elements of the story which are more like fairy tales, which may not be true, so they are all built on top of the actual story. But then there are some historians or some philosophers, some thinkers who want to believe that it was just all made up story. It actually just represents a human being, and the war is just between our good and bad sides of the human being, etc., etc. So all kinds of interpretations are given. Okay. I don't know enough about history. So I don't put my mouth anywhere, you know. Whether
it doesn't really matter. I suppose the point of the story is the moral, or the, you know.
Yes. So the underlying message is very important. It's very beautiful. I'm more interested in the message rather than the historicity of, you know, whether it's...
I'm curious, honestly, because it's told with such detail in, you know, the people and things. It made me wonder.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's very true. A lot of people wonder and... there's no yes or no answer. But like I said, the believers, they believe it's absolutely true. Yeah. So, it goes back, like I said, many generations, but we'll pick up the story when the king dies, and he had two sons. One was called Pandu, the other was called Dhritarashtra. So that's important to kind of start the point. Now, according to the laws of the land, a blind person could not become the king. He could not be the hold the kingdom. So Dhritarashtra, he was a blind person, so he could not be given the kingdom, even though he was older of the two brothers. So normally the older brother is given the kingdom when the father dies, but he could not be given the kingdom. So Pandu, the younger brother, was given the kingdom. Now, unfortunately, Pandu died young, and his kids were relatively young at that time. So then they had to agree, because there was no other person to hold the kingdom, the kids were very small. So even though Dhritarashtra was blind, he was made the king at that time. Okay, in the interim period until these kids grew up to be adults and they'll become the king. Now, the kids of Pandu, they were called Pandavas, and Yudhishthira's kids were called Kauravas. Have you heard the terms? You should be familiar with these terms, because this is a fight between Pandavas and Kauravas. Okay, so, and the five brothers, you know, of the Pandu clan. Five brothers, their names are, again, you may not remember these, but at least you should listen to the names. Yudhishthira. You want to repeat them after me? Yudhishthira. Bhima, Arjuna,
Nakula,
Sahadeva.
Sahadeva.
Okay, so this is important because they are the good guys. You know, they belong to the good side. And the other side, the Kauravas, I mean, these are again stories, they said they were 100 in number. 100 brothers. And the only name that you need to know out of those 100 is the oldest one, who was the troublemaker, you know, the oldest of the Duryodhana. His name was Duryodhana. Duryodhana. Alright? So, while the kids were growing up, these 100 princes on one side and 5 of Pandus, they were all given under the care of Dhritarashtra, who was the blind king. So he put them in their natural schooling and whatever, you know, they because they were warrior kings, they had to learn all the arts of war, archery and, you know, everything that goes with it, fighting. Okay, so those plus other spiritual learning, they were all very, all the kings were supposed to be very spiritually advanced also. So not only in the warfare, but in the other literature and all the ancient scriptures, they were all supposed to be very well versed in all those things. But because they were all under the care of this Dhritarashtra king, they all went to the same school, so they all had the same teachers, same gurus, and same kind of learning they all learnt. All right? Now, the way things developed, this Kauravas, they started becoming very, very jealous of these Pandavas. Why? Because the Pandavas, they excelled in almost everything. So when you go to school, you know, there are some kids who are very bright and they excel in everything. This is what Pandavas did. All right? And so they were, all of them, they were in some field, they were very good. Like Arjuna was the best archer of his time. Bhima was the most strongest, physically the strongest person, etc., etc. Okay, so they all had very special characteristics and they excelled in their own fields. And the Kauravas, they became very jealous of these. Now, when they grew up, when they were old enough to take on the kingdom, so they, even though technically the eldest of the Pandavas should be the king, right? To Dhritarashtra, he should have been the king because his father was the king. So, but because they were under the care of this other king now, so they said, let's divide the kingdom. Alright? So half the kingdom was given to the Pandavas and half was given to the Kauravas. Alright, and the name of their capital is given here. The Pandavas, their capital was Indraprastha, and Kauravas, their kingdom, their capital was Hastinapur. And these are all the names of cities which are now in India. For example, Indraprastha is currently, its name of that city is New Delhi. Have you heard the name New Delhi? Mm-hmm. That's the capital of India. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the Hastinapur is another small town which is right next to New Delhi. Okay. Now, these people were so jealous, these Duryodhana and the Kauravas, that they really wanted to get rid of the Pandavas. So they schemed everything possible within their power to either kill them, harm them in some way, or subdue them in some way, etc., etc. They even, and at one time, one of the stories goes that they said, oh, there's a beautiful country fair at some place and you should take a vacation there. And so they made them go there and they made them stay in a sort of a small palace that they, small kind of, vacation home that they built for them. But they What they did was to make, build that home using material which is inflammable. So it could be put to flames. So the idea was that one night when they would be sleeping in there, Duryodhana and his guys would go and burn that whole place out. Okay. But somehow they found out about this plan, this scheme, and they were able to dig an underground tunnel so that they could run away and escape from there. But they were also clever. So what they did was, on the day that they planned to escape through the tunnel, they themselves put the whole thing into fire and put some kind of a show there that would show something like five dead bodies or something like that. There are all kinds of stories there. There's a story that there was another woman who was serving them. She had five kids, and it looked like they knew their wife, and you know, that woman died, etc. Anyway, so they made it look like they had died, and the house got burnt, and they died in that. But they escaped into the forest, and they remained in the forest for some time, etc. There are all kinds of stories in there. And while they were living kind of in the forest, they also started serving as a servant. You know, they made up themselves to be as servants and then served another king. And during that time, you know, one of the kings had a daughter that they wanted to get married, etc. So in the old days, you know, they used to have this ceremony where the kings would hold a ceremony, and then the woman would be able to choose her husband depending on the conditions that they had put. Okay? I don't know if you have time for all these stories, but I hope they're interesting.
Very, very interesting.
Okay. But anyway, this king had this condition that what he did was they had a huge long pole. And at the top of the pole they had the replica of a bird sitting on top of the pole. Then at the very bottom of that pole they had a pond of water. Okay? So what these archers were required to do was to not look at the bird, but look at the reflection of the bird in that water, in that pond of water. Okay? And they were all going to be given five arrows. Okay? Five arrows and a bow. And this was a very heavy bow, something that you had to be strong to even lift the bow up. And then put those five arrows in there. And you were supposed to, looking at the reflection, you're supposed to strike the bird which is sitting on top of the pole. So everyone tried, you know, like the story goes, everyone tried, they failed, nobody could get through to the bird. And finally this guy Arjuna, you know, he was still in the guise of a servant, but he said, "Let me try." So they said, "Who? You're not even a prince." He said, "Let me try anyway." They said, you know, because everyone had failed, so they let him try. And in his very first try, he put all the five arrows through the eye of the bird. So they had to give this woman to him in marriage. But then the story goes on. Lord Krishna came over and they somehow found out who these people were, and they were thrilled to know that these are the princes and all that. So they go back home with their new woman Arjuna got married to, and they declare to their mother who was inside the house, "Hey mom, look what we got." She says, "You are five brothers, doesn't matter what you have, share it nicely among all the five of you." So they were required to marry this woman, all five of them, because that's what the mother's word, share them. So that's how she became the wife of all the five. And that's the story. Anyway, so there are lots of stories, you know, I can keep on going, and people read these stories for months and months, you know. and keep going. Now, while they were doing all this, this guy Duryodhana really wanted to harm them somehow. So they invited them for a game of dice. It was a cultural thing in those days that if one king invites the other king for a game of dice, you're not supposed to refuse. That was just one of the cultural things there. So they, and this guy, Duryodhana's uncle, okay, his name was Shakuni, he was a very clever guy. He either knew the game so well that he could defeat almost anybody, or in the Mahabharata it says that he also was able to do something to these dice, what is it called?
Dice,
yeah, whatever. He was able to imbalance them so that he knew how to throw the dice and get the right numbers. So he was able to cheat, basically. In any case, the game was held, and this guy, Dhritarashtra, the main king, you know, who was the eldest of the Pandavas, Arjuna's oldest brother, he kept betting stuff, and eventually he lost everything. When I say everything, it meant everything. He lost his kingdom. He lost his entire wealth. He even finally betted their wife, Draupadi. So they lost their wife also in the whole thing. And things kept going, and finally they said, "You've lost everything. What the punishment that we want to give you now is that you should go into the forest for 12 years. Okay? You were sent to the forest for 12 years. And then they said, "We will add one more year. During the 13th year, you have to remain completely incognito. That means nobody should ever be able to recognize you. If they did, you will add another 12 years to your punishment." Okay, so that was the punishment they said for losing your bets. So they finished the 12 years, 13 years, you know, they came back and then asked for the kingdom back. They were given half the kingdom before they left. He said, "Who the hell are you? We don't want to give you anything." So he says, "We are five brothers. Give us five villages, you know, small villages, not the entire kingdom, but give us five villages." They said, "Nothing." So give us one village, no way. And he says, Duryodhana says, and in the Mahabharata it says that he refused to give them the space which could be covered by the tip of a needle, not even that much space. So it was a big problem. Now what do they do, you know? And they were the rightful owners of their kingdom. So this is now getting into their territory. So they consulted with Krishna and they said, "Krishna, can you go and try to make some peace with this guy? He is hell-bent on creating war and all that." Nobody wanted war, because war is destructive. So they finally sent Krishna, and Duryodhana even insulted Krishna. He tried to arrest him, put him in jail. But of course, Krishna being Godhead, he was able to escape and all that. But Krishna, once he came back, he said, "This is it. You know, war has to be held. There's no way other than war, because this guy is totally not amenable to any kind of peace." So then, of course, Krishna also offered his support to both, because they were all cousins. So he said, "Okay, you know, I'll make you an offer. There are two options I have. One is, one of you will have me alone, without I will not hold a weapon in my hands, and that's all you'll get. And the other side will get my entire powerful army." He was also like the king of a very powerful army. So the story goes that, you know, they both were sitting there, and Krishna saw Arjuna first, so he said, "Okay, you go first. You ask for which of the two options." He obviously opted for Krishna, because he was his friend and his guide. And the other guy, Duryodhana, was so thrilled. Look at this idiot. It's a war. He says, what's more important in war? An unarmed person or a whole army? You know, it was obvious. So in any case, they were very thrilled. So their army was like 12 divisions, Duryodhana's army, whereas Pandava's army was 7 divisions. So it was much smaller in terms of the number. So that's how the whole war took place, because they could not get a peace deal with this guy, because he was so hungry for power, so hungry for kingdom, and he had tasted the kingdom for 12, 13 years now and really enjoyed it. Okay. So Krishna said there's no other way except to have war, and then we'll fight. Now Arjuna asked him, can you please be my charioteer for this, you know, for the wars? With everyone, all these warriors have chariots that they go in. So they agree. Arjuna says, please be my charioteer. And Krishna says, okay, I'll be your charioteer. So I was... So the strange thing here is that this dialogue, which is a very spiritual dialogue in nature, where does it take place? It's in the middle of a battlefield, not in an ashram, not in a monastery. That's where you normally expect a spiritual dialogue to happen, right? So what happened was, you know, this guy, Arjuna, he said, look, can you please place my chariot somewhere in the middle of the two armies so I can see who is, you know, on each side, and I know exactly who I'm fighting against. And Krishna said, okay, you know, he put his chariot in a place where he could see all the important warriors on each side. And then on the other side, Duryodhana's side, he was confronted with, you know, like every one of his teachers, you know, like I mentioned, all these 105 princes, they were all trained by the same teachers. But because of, you know, there was a gap of 13 years, Duryodhana in the meantime had made everyone agree that they will fight or they will be on his side. In any case, because he was the king, you're supposed to be very loyal to the king. Whether you are a fighter, whether you are a teacher, it doesn't matter. So all these teachers who were the teachers of both the sides, they were all on Duryodhana's side. Now Arjuna, when he sees that, look, this guy is my teacher, this guy is my uncle, this guy is my granduncle, and everyone is a relative, obviously. He says, I'm going to fight these people and kill them in battle. He really becomes very, very disheartened. He doesn't like the thought, he doesn't like the idea that he's going to fight and kill all these people. And he is, at that point, he's very confused. He really doesn't want to fight. He tells Krishna, look, I have no desire for kingdom, I have no desire for any sovereignty. All I need is peace, but if peace is not there, I want to give up. I want to run into the forest, become a monk, so that I can, you know, realize myself eventually. So this is the start of the Bhagavad Gita. That whole story is the kind of background as to how this whole war took place and why Krishna had to give a dialogue or give a sermon to Arjuna so that he could fight. Because all he wanted Arjuna was to do is to fight. That's his duty as a warrior prince. You know, that's your duty. If you're a warrior prince, you have to fight. And Arjuna at that time was despondent. He was completely disheartened and he didn't want to fight. So that's where the whole story begins, the whole dialogue begins, okay? This is just a picture of the chariot and the five horses that are attached to the chariot. The driver of the chariot is Krishna, and they at the back is the archer, Arjuna. You can see that. All right. Now there's a symbolism of the chariot that's given in both one of the Upanishads, which is called the Kathopanishad, and Gita. So they are both exactly identical symbolism. Okay, so what's the symbolism? That the chariot is the body, basically. The human body is the chariot. The five horses are representing the five senses. Sense of touch, you know, sight, etc., etc. Five senses. And the reins of the chariot, which Krishna is controlling, they symbolize the mind, because mind is supposed to control. Whether it's the lower mind or the higher mind, that depends on how the control is, how good or bad the control is. Okay? Krishna is the pure intelligence. He is the pure consciousness, representing the pure consciousness. Okay, Krishna. All right. And the passenger, in this case Arjuna, he is confused. So he represents the confused mind, which is the ego-based mind. So he represents the ego, or the, I'll call it the false ego. And the body is the chariot. This whole body is the chariot. And you can take it in any direction you want. You can go after the five senses or sense objects, or you can control it and not be attached to anything. Okay, so that's the symbolism. The war of Kurukshetra is the individual conflicts that we go through all the time. Always we have a conflict, whether it's the upper mind or the lower mind, the higher mind or the lower mind, which is dictating things. In the Yoga Sutras, we talked about the ego versus the intellect. You remember roughly? Intellect and the ego. So that's the conflict we always have. And then the Kauravas and Pandavas are our negative and positive tendencies. You remember the term we used was samskaras? You remember that? Past impressions.
Hmm? I was going to say delusion, but false impression.
Past impressions. And they could be either positive or negative, and that's what drives our actions, drives our motives in our actions, etc. So that's what the symbolism is in the Gita, as well as in the one of the Upanishads called the Kathopanishad. Okay. So this is just a summary of the main message of Gita. Alright. Again, these are bullet lists that I understand, okay? So they're not from any other text. They're my thoughts, all right? Some of these. The main message that comes to my mind is that you have to resist evil. Duryodhana, okay, the bad king, he represented evil because he did not represent reason. So he's evil. So actively resist evil. That's why Krishna agreed to war. The next message is, know that you are the eternal spiritual self. The only thing that is permanent is the self. Everything else is transient. Everything else is changeable. We all know that, right? Only the pure self is permanent. It has no beginning, it has no end. Everyone okay with that? Okay. Now, there's a message in the Gita that stabilize the mind by overcoming desires. This word desires and attractions and attachments, it gets repeated over and over and over again in the Gita. Since you've been studying Gita, you probably have noticed there's a lot of repetition in Gita. A lot of repetition. The same thought, the same idea gets repeated over and over again in many, many of the verses. Now, some readers, they think it is distracting, but most commentators believe it is only to re-emphasize and establish the concept that Krishna wants you to understand. So repetition is good because it re-emphasizes the whole concept. And you're more likely to retain it when it is repeated so many times. Okay? Some guys believe that, you know, it is very distracting because he repeats the same thing over and over again, but I think to me it's very reconstructive, basically. Okay? So like this, overcoming desires is a concept that is mentioned in many, many verses. Non-attachment is a very key concept. What's non-attachment?
For one thing, doing something without being attached to the outcome.
Right. Without being attached to the object itself and to the outcome of your action. Both. Okay? So if I'm attached, for example, if I like my cup of coffee 7 in the morning, okay, I'm attached to it. Right? And the outcome of it might be that if I have the cup of coffee, I'm satisfied and happy. If I, for some reason, if I'm not able to get a cup of coffee, I'm miserable. I get a headache, I can't go to the toilet, things like that. All those things happen. That's attachment. Right? So you're attached to the object itself or to the outcome of whatever action that object represents. Right? And the concept of non-attachment, do you remember it was mentioned in the Yoga Sutras also? Do you remember the term used in Sanskrit?
I do, I can't think about it.
There were two things mentioned. Practice and non-attachment, remember?
Abhyasa
and Vairagya. Right? And in the Gita also the same two words are mentioned. Abhyasa and Vairagya. Same, exactly the same terms. Same Sanskrit words are used in the Gita also. So non-attachment becomes a very key characteristics of this whole concept in Gita. See? There's another term in Sanskrit which is Sthita Prajna. It is described in chapter 2 in several of the verses. What that means is basically that you have to get established in a supreme kind of natural wisdom, very deep inner wisdom. And how do you do that? You know, that's mentioned in these few verses in chapter 2 that I mentioned. And then there is a statement about doership. Am I the doer? Am I doing things? Again, the statement keeps repeating in the Gita that I am not the doer. I should not think of myself as the doer. I am not the doer of anything. And we'll come to that, what that statement means. Okay? Okay. And then it says, acknowledge the presence of God in you, in yourself. You are the pure consciousness. That's God, representation of God. Not only in you, but everything else is a representation of God. And then you surrender to God with devotion. Remember we use the term in the Yoga Sutras, surrender to God with devotion. You remember anything like that? Mm-hmm. What was that term called? You remember the five yamas and niyamas? Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Five niyamas? Anybody remember the five niyamas?
Yes, niyamas.
Shaucha.
Santosha.
Santosha. No?
I know. Let's see. I know there's
five niyamas.
Study.
Yes. Good. So say that in English, yeah.
Fourth, yeah. And then fifth is I can't come up with the term. But basically like a union or like a junction or something like that.
So five niyamas are shaucha, which is purity and cleanliness. Santosha is contentment. Tapas is austerities. Then self-study, as you mentioned, which is Swadhyaya. And then Ishvara Pranidhana, which is surrender to God, surrender to that true ultimate reality. That's the statement here that I wanted to, because surrender to God with total devotion, utmost devotion, And that is mentioned in the Gita almost in every chapter. Krishna says, just come to me. I am your savior, I am your everything. Just devote yourself to me. I am the Lord, I am the Supreme Consciousness, I am God. Come to me. That's mentioned in almost every chapter, you will notice that. That's Krishna's saying. Okay, and then another very important message is, you should know, understand, learn the three gunas. It's very important. Okay? Alright, so now we move on to the major paths of yoga. Now, when you study the Gita, you just go chapter by chapter. How do you study it? Or is there a break, like you concept by concept or chapter by chapter?
I read through chapter by chapter. Yeah. Back to back, yeah.
Okay. And is there somebody who is teaching you this, or you're doing it on your own?
The reading?
Just on our own.
Hmm? On your own? There's no regular class or anything for that? Oh, I see. No, the reason I'm asking is because the concepts of Gita are not easy to understand. Okay? And you either need a very, very good thorough commentary, or even better, somebody who can explain to you, you know, the concepts in depth. Otherwise it becomes very hard. Just like the sutras in Patanjali's, you need somebody to explain them to you. Otherwise they are so obscure and terse, it doesn't make much sense. Same thing. And, you know, like we always joke in our Gita study group, you know, I've been going for the Gita study for almost 15, 16 years now. And we always joke, hey, I've gone through the Gita many times, all right? I've studied the Gita many times. But then the teachers will ask you, you've gone through the Gita many times, but has the Gita gone through you? That's the question. And we always say, no, it hasn't gone through me yet. We still have more questions than we have answers. Because the concepts are so deep and sometimes so obscure that you need to be able to experience them. You just cannot understand them intellectually. Our intellects are extremely limited. Our mind is very limited. It has only so much capacity. But these concepts go beyond any intellectual understanding. Therefore, they say that you have to experience that true nature of yourself before you can understand these concepts. Whether it's the Yoga Sutras or the Gita, same thing. So, I always like to add, you know, look, whatever I am sharing with you is based on my level of intellectual understanding. It's not experiential. I have not experienced that ultimate state of mind, you know, which is called samadhi or true yoga, etc. So, what I'm sharing is a purely intellectual understanding that I have. Okay, so that's what we will do now. Go through these four major parts of yoga. Okay. Again, now what I have done is picked a few verses which represent each one of these categories. How did I pick them? Just based on my own understanding. As I go through them, you know, as I go through the Gita, this looks like Karma Yoga. Let me add it to it. And this looks like Jnana Yoga, so I'll add it under that category. That's how I have done it. You know, I've not been able to consult any book or anything so far. Now what we will do is to kind of read through these, because this is very important to just read through them. And our time is limited, so I will not be able to, you know, we will not have a very detailed discussion. But while you're reading this, if you come across a word or a phrase or a concept or an idea which you don't understand, we'll spend some time on it. How's that? Okay? So we're going to take turns now. One at a time, we'll start reading these from top to bottom. All right? So you'd go with the first one?
Sure. Treating pleasure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat alike. Engage yourself in your duty and fight. Thus, you will not incur any sin.
Your choice is in...
Hold on. Before we go on, is there any... does any thought come to mind when you read the sentence? The first one.
I have a question.
Yes.
I have a question about the meaning of fight in that statement.
Fight. Well, this is a war. So fight means go pick up your weapon and fight. Mm-hmm. That's a real... I mean, this is the real fight.
Yes. Okay. I guess I was taking...
Now, you know, when you go to a metaphorical concept, then fight simply means that you try to overcome your negative emotions, the negative samskara. So fight means that you have to fight to the point where your intellect becomes so sharp that your ego is not able to dominate you. That's the fight that we're talking about at the metaphorical level. But in the actual war, Krishna says, pick up your weapon, don't sit down there, don't be despondent, just fight.
So that represents Vairagya, so the detachment, representing detachment.
Detachment, yes. So, treating pleasure and pain alike, you know, it doesn't matter. When you fight, you will have moments of pleasure and pain, but don't get overcome by those things. Okay? And gain and loss, again the same thing, you know, when you fight, you can either gain, you win or lose, doesn't matter. But don't be attached to the outcome. Don't be attached to your own likes and dislikes. So victory and defeat, engage yourself in your duty. Your duty is to fight, that's the whole concept of karma yoga. Alright, now go on to the next one. Now, this sentence is one of the most quoted verses from Gita, one of the most quoted. If you visit India, if you go to a temple, you go to a school or an office, corporate building, it doesn't matter where, at least somewhere you will see this inscribed on the walls of the building, this particular statement. It is so commonly referenced. It means you have to understand what your duty is. And you do that duty to the ultimate ability that you have. Okay? But do not worry about the outcome of what you have to do. Okay? If you're working for a corporation, for example, right? What is your duty? Your duty is to make the bottom line higher, basically. That's what every corporation wants, right? Now, whatever you have to do to attain that goal, you have to do that. But let's say that goal is not met. Okay? Don't worry about it. It's okay. Because that's not in your hands. Why, they always say, you know, there's the 80-20 rule, right? No matter what you do, only 20% of the outcome is in your hands, 80% is out of your hands. Have you heard that 80-20 rule?
Not context, but yeah, many times. It's
yeah.
A lot of mystery.
Hmm?
Also a law of diminishing returns. You
right.
Get, you know, 80% done and you get much benefit, but doing the last 20% takes 80% of the effort. It's not worth
right.
It.
But they always invoke this rule 80-20 that you have control over 20%. Everything else, 80% is out of your control, no matter what you do. Whether it's your health, whether it's your corporate job, whether it's your family, doesn't matter. Okay? So why bother then? And if it's 80% out of my control, who am I to control that then? And why am I upset about the whole thing? You know? And that gives you that sense of non-attachment then. You know, okay, I have to do my job, I have to do the best I can, and that's what the next one says. So you want to read the next one?
Do your duty to the best of your ability, O Arjuna, with your mind attached to the Lord, abandoning worry and selfish attachment to the results and remaining calm in both success and failure. Evenness of mind is called yoga.
Evenness of mind is called yoga. That's another. That's kind of a definition of yoga that Gita gives. That your mind, when it can stay even, unperturbed, undisturbed, okay, and no matter what the situation is, that's yoga. How is yoga defined in the Yoga Sutras? Does anybody remember? Second sutra in the Yoga Sutras, definition of yoga. Chitta vritti nirodha, remember, do you remember that statement? Calming the mind. Keeping the mind calm under all circumstances, that's the definition of yoga. Which is not very different from what it is here. What it's saying is, stay calm no matter what happens. No matter what you get as a result of your actions, no matter what situation you are thrust into, stay calm. That's the definition of yoga here also. Evenness of the mind is yoga. Samatvam yoga uchyate. That is the Sanskrit phrase that he uses. Samatvam means no matter what situation you are in, you maintain very calm, very collected, peaceful. Okay, next sentence.
Therefore, without being attached to the fruits of activities, one should act as a matter of duty. For by working without attachment, one attains the supreme.
No attachment. These are the statements that, like I said, they repeat in Gita, many different places, the same kind of concepts, with slight difference maybe. Next one.
He who gives up attachment to action and their fruits is ever content. Such a person, though engaged in activity, does nothing at all and incurs no karmic reaction.
Do you understand this statement? What's karmic reaction? What does that mean to you?
Would have no impact on what your kind of future would be?
Yes. Yes. Very good. Remember in the sutra session we talked about three different karmas? Do you remember that discussion at all? What is karma, first of all? What's the karma theory in general?
So karma generally is actions, right?
And yes.
Then, the actions that you have in this life kind of resonate in your future reincarnation.
Right. Right. So whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever we could perceive in this life, it gets accumulated in our bag of karma, so to say. Remember that bag of karma? Okay, and which gets carried forward into future lives. And then somebody somewhere up there, you know, he will dish out some part of that karma bag for your future, for the next life. What gets dished out, that you cannot change. Once it's dished out to you, you have to go through that karma for this entire span of your life. But it gets dished out from a huge bag of karma. It's like a huge bank balance that you carry forward, and out of that, certain sub amount of that bank balance is given to you for this life. Okay? But when you are in this life, you can accumulate more karma by doing things good or bad. If you do good things, it will be good karma accumulated. Bad things, bad karma accumulated. What he's saying is that if you are completely non-attached, zero attachment to whatever you're doing, then whatever you do not add any more karma to this bag now. You will still have to go through what karma was given to you before you started this lifespan. But you will not add any more karma to it, which means the karma bag will not get more filled up with more things. Do you get the idea? That's the meaning of this, that you will not incur any more karmic reaction. That karmic reaction is filling the karma bag. So there are three types of karmas, remember. One is the full, total collection of karma, the whole bag, which is the bag that gets filled up from the past. multiple millions of previous lives, millions, you know, everything's getting connected, right? And then what you get dished out for this life, that's called prarabdha karma. That's the karma that you live through in this life, no matter what happens. No matter you become even if you become a self-enlightened person, and let's say you become, I'm just picking a silly example, that the age of 50 you become self-enlightened, but your karma said that at the age of 52 you will have cancer, you will go through that. Even though you are enlightened, you know, self-realized and all that, if the karma back said that you will have cancer at that age, you will do that. Okay? Then you can add more karma to your own bag. Alright? Okay. Alright, let's read the next one.
Everyone is forced to act helplessly according to the qualities he has acquired from the modes of material nature, gunas. Therefore, no one can refrain from doing something, not even for money.
So it's not that you can, because you don't want to incur more karma or karma bag, you know, it doesn't mean that you can just sit idle and do nothing. That's not possible. That's not humanly possible. Because the gunas, remember the three gunas now? Okay. Do you know the three gunas?
I can remember them now. Is it the Raja, Sattva, and Tamas?
What is Sattva?
Inertia. Yeah, some of the words, some of the books I've read say.
No, sattva. I'm talking about sattva.
Sattva, yeah. Not doing rajas is too active, right? The sattva is good, inertia is just going along.
No. Inertia is usually associated with tamas, darkness. Okay, sattva is all purity, good, positive stuff. Okay. Inertia is where you maintain status quo. That's more toward tamas. What is rajas? Active. Action, aggression, ambition, attachment, detachment, all those, you know, desires, you know, ambitions, etc. They are all a part of rajas. Okay? But the main theme is that these gunas, they are constantly changing in your mind, in your life, basically. At every aspect of your being, the gunas are changing. And the same thing is happening in the mind as well. So these three gunas, if one of them is dominant at this moment, the very next moment something else could be dominant. And it is the dominance of these gunas which keeps changing, and they are the combinations that propel you to do work. Okay? If at this time your guna is, let's say, sattva is dominant, and you are deeply interested in studying some spiritual stuff here, okay, so you'll be doing stuff which is related to that. You're still doing something. You're not sitting idle. You are either listening or reading or studying or whatever is happening, something is happening. Okay? And suddenly after this class, you know, you have to maybe become rajasic and do a class on vinyasa flow yoga, you know. Who knows? That will be a combination of sattva and rajas then. Right? So, and every moment things change. Alright? So the point here is that you cannot refrain from doing something at any given moment. You have to do something. But all they are saying is eventually do whatever you do, but with a sense of non-attachment. That's eventually the goal. Okay, let's read the next one.
Actions arise from the gunas. The knower of the gunas knows that all actions are caused by the triple modes of nature. Only the ignorant thinks I am the doer.
So again, this statement gets repeated in the Gita many times. I am not the doer. You have to know that I am not the doer. Who is I? The pure consciousness. Pure consciousness is doing nothing. It's just observing. Who is doing things? It's the combination of the three gunas. So the gunas are responsible for whatever is happening through me as the medium. I am the medium for doing things. But who is the doer? Actual job is being done by the gunas, because the gunas are changing their dominance from moment to moment, and that's what is making the action. Everyone get that? That's a very important concept, because in the Gita you will come across this statement many times, I'm not the doer, I'm not the doer. And for many years, you know, when I heard that statement, it was confused me, because they will tell you that you are not the doer, but they don't tell you who's the doer then, who's doing it. They tell you, but you're not paying attention, basically, in the Gita. And you have to really, when I read this statement in chapter 3, I got the answer finally. I'm not the doer, but the gunas are the doers. Gunas are a part of my material nature. And that's what is making me do things. You get the idea? It's a very important concept. So you can, in your own mind, chapter 3, verse 27 becomes a very important verse. At least for me it became very important, because I finally got the answer that I was looking for many years.
So the gunas are reacting from material nature.
Yes. Gunas comprise the material nature. Material nature is the composite of these three gunas. And these three gunas keep changing constantly. And that is why we are driven to action based on whichever is dominant at a given time. If the tamas is more active, I might go to sleep, or I might just sit and watch football, eating some chips, drinking beer, or whatever. I'm just making things up. If rajas is dominant, I might be doing some gung-ho things, you know, I want to be do this, you know. Rajas and they work in combination. Sometimes sattva and rajas are dominant, so they both work together. Okay? Sattva will say, I want to do yoga practice now. Rajas will say, okay, let's go into the warrior pose. You know? So these are constantly things are happening in that sense. Okay?
So because there are kind of negative connotations for the, you know, outlier, so you got, you know, sattva in the middle, so that's good. The other are not as good, right? So it seems like some aspect of you, you know, would kind of choose the better, right? So you'd say, you know, I don't want to be this hyperactivity, I want to be calm, right? So how does that play into the gunas, right? So if the gunas cause action, can you influence the gunas?
Yes. So that's the whole idea, is to influence the gunas through our practices that we do. You know, in the yoga sutras we said 8 limbs of yoga. You do these 8 limbs of yoga, and what that does eventually is to make the sattva guna more dominant compared to the other two. Okay? And it's only when the sattva guna is more dominant can you make the intellect more prominent, more dominant compared to the ego. But eventually, what the Gita and what the Yoga Sutra say, that you have to transcend the gunas altogether. You know, the non-attachment vairagya that we defined in the Yoga Sutras also said that we have to go and transcend the three gunas before we can get completely non-attached. It's the same concept in the Gita. Okay? They say go beyond the gunas eventually. Even you have to go past sattva guna also. Even though it's like the mind, you know. They say you have to go through the mind to quell the mind. Same thing, you have to go through the gunas to eventually become totally independent of the gunas. Okay? Does that make sense? Yes. All right. Let's now move on to the Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of
wisdom,
or knowledge or wisdom. Yeah, very good. Okay, next. Who's reading next?
Arjuna, the one who knows the self to be indestructible, timeless, unborn, and not subject to decline, how and whom does that person kill? Whom does he cause to kill?
Do you get a sense of what it means here? See, Arjuna was completely devastated by the sight of his own people, his own clan, his own gurus, his own teachers and cousins and fathers and grandfathers and uncles. He doesn't want to fight. So what Krishna is trying to tell him is that, look, we are all nothing but the pure soul, pure consciousness, which is totally, it is permanent, it is eternal. The consciousness or the soul or atma or the self is purely eternal. It has no beginning, it has no end, nobody can kill it, nobody can burn it. Okay, there is a statement here that atma is something that cannot be killed, it cannot be burnt, wind cannot take it away, fire cannot burn it, etc., etc., all that. Okay? And the point is that because everyone is nothing but the self eventually, all right? And the self is unborn. It's not, you cannot kill it. So now, as a warrior, as a person who is given to fight evil, if you kill the other person, all you're doing is to demolishing his body, but not his soul. In fact, you're doing something good to the other body, because his body, his material being, is full of evil. You want that soul to become rid of that evil. So in fact, you're doing something really good if you kill that person. But because the soul is, when I say they kill the person, I'm saying killing the physical body. It's only the physical body that's going to demolish. But the soul being eternal, nothing is happening to it. So really, you're not killing anything. You're not causing anybody to be killed, or you're not killing yourself, anybody. Because what you're representing is pure soul, pure consciousness. The material aspect is fully ridden, it's ridden with evil thoughts. And we want to get rid of that evil. So that's the kind of the basic message why Krishna said, fighting is good for you, and you really have to fight. Not just good, it is your duty to fight.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the karma, going back to that for a second. That karma being, like, that body is making evil choices and that sort of thing. So does that cause one's karma to not be so great in the next
Yes.
life?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It does. All right, so that's this one. Next one, who's reading?
To me. Just as a person puts on a new garment after discarding the old ones, the individual soul acquires new bodies after casting away the old ones.
This is the very basic concept of reincarnation. Is everyone roughly familiar with that? Right? So how do you explain reincarnation? In these terms, what's reincarnation? What happens?
Soul gets a new body. That's a big oversimplification of it. Your soul gets a new body.
Right, right. So your soul is a loose term. What are all the things that go into the new body? That's what you have to understand. You know, there are these terms they call the subtle body and the gross body, right? It's the subtle body which is attached to the soul. The gross body is not attached to the soul. Gross body is just physical, you know, these five elements, earth, water, air, fire, and ether. That's the five elements that's the gross body. And that's the one which is going to go back to the five elements. So that does not get attached to the new body. What gets attached to the new body is the soul, which is completely messed up with the subtle body. I call it messed up because it doesn't know the reality. It doesn't know that the soul has to be totally independent of the material aspect. It's meshed. It's linked in with the material aspect of the subtle body. And so it's all one. So what goes into the next physical body is this entire subtle body. Subtle body includes what? The intellect, the mind, the ego, the five sense perceptions, and all the elements of our samskara, the bag of karma that we have. That all is completely meshed together, and that's all what is dumped onto the next body. Or some part of it, not the entire thing, but some part of that is dumped into the new body. That's the whole concept of reincarnation. Okay? So that's what it's talking about here. That just like a person gives up old clothes, old garments, and puts on new ones, the same thing. This whole body is getting rid of this old garment, which is just the subtle body and the soul, and then gets a new body in the future. New garments. So the soul is just like a garment, basically.
So when you talked about the subtle body, you mentioned four of the five sheaths that were mentioned in one of the books that we read. Five sheaths being, you know, the soul, intellect, mind, the senses right outside of the prana, like energy basically was in there, and described in these five sheaths. So is that one of the subtle, or part of the subtle body?
That's, you know, you can think of that in that sense also. The Yoga Sutras, they don't talk of the five sheaths. The Gita doesn't talk of the five sheaths, but they are coming from, that concept of five sheaths comes from one of the Upanishads. Okay? What are the five sheaths? Let's repeat them.
Soul, middle, or the
abdomen. Let's go at the physical level first.
What? So the senses on the outside?
Physical level.
Yeah.
It's called the physical. So the sheaths, the term used is the, do you remember the Sanskrit term? Kosha. Okay? So the first one is the Annamaya Kosha, which is the physical body sustained by food. Annamaya Kosha. Second is the vital body sustained by breath. Pranamaya Kosha. Okay. Third is the mental body sustained by our thoughts and emotions and the intellects, etc. That's the third body. I'm not sure if we are talking of the same concept. Same thing, right? Okay, so the first is the physical body, second is the vital body sustained by breath, third is the mental body, fourth is called the intuitive body. That's pure intuition, which is beyond the intellect and the mind. Pure intuition. The fifth is called the ananda or blissful body. Are we talking about the same thing? Okay, that's called ananda kosha. Ananda means bliss. Now, these all five represent the physical, material aspect of our being, separate from the soul. So what they're telling us is that these five layers, these five sheaths, represent the physical, material aspect of our being, separate from the soul, because soul is purely the observer of all these things that are going on in this material aspect. And the whole idea of yoga, then when we talk about yoga, is to realize that separation. That my soul is purely an observer of all these five things that are going on constantly in the mind, in the material aspect. And what's going on is all determined by the gunas. The three gunas are the ones that determine what's going on in this material aspect. And the soul is purely an observer. It's called drashta in Sanskrit, observer.
So of those sheets, the animal body on the outside is the one that gets left behind.
Like physical body, yes.
And then the rest of them are the soul.
Right.
Ah, thank you.
Right. Yes.
That was from one of the Iyengar books we read, it was light on yoga.
Like I said, it's not in the Gita, it's not in the Yoga Sutras, but it's come from an Upanishad. But then, because that concept is so important and so meaningful, that every author brings that concept in of the five sheaths. So you'll see that in the commentaries of almost every literature, you will see that concept brought in. It's so important. Because it makes a lot of things understand us, you know, makes it easier to understand. So yes. So the physical body is the lowest level of the lowest sheath, and everything else is the subtle body. And that gets entangled with the soul, because at that time the soul doesn't know that it's separate, therefore it is all meshed together. That all goes to the next body. Is that okay with you?
Interesting.
Okay, who's reading the next one?
The indweller of the physical body, the one who is self-controlled, having renounced all actions mentally by knowledge, remains happily in the non-gated city, the body, neither performing action nor causing others.
Again, it's talking about the soul. Because the indweller of the physical body, indweller, he's talking about the soul. Soul is the indweller in the body. And the nine gated city, so this is one of the ways they describe this physical body. It has nine openings. Nine gates, nine openings. You know the nine openings? Ears, two ears, two eyes, two nostrils, and the mouth. That's seven. And two openings in the bottom.
Elimination, yeah.
Okay, elimination. Mm-hmm. Got that? That's the nine gates. That's how they call it, the nine-gated city. Body. Okay. So, again, the soul is not going to cause any action. That's exactly the same point they are again repeating here from the point of perspective of the wisdom part now. And look, you have to understand the whole concept of the soul being separate and not being a part of this physical body. So that's why it's not causing any action or not doing any action itself. The action is being done by the three gunas all the time. That's the key phrase that we have to keep in mind. All right. Who's next?
Death is certain of that which is born. Birth is certain of that which is dead. Therefore, you should not lament over the inevitable.
So, again, the same message. Krishna says, fight. Because if one is born, you have to die. If you die, you have to be reborn, unless you are self-realized. So just keep fighting. Doesn't matter at that point then. Get the idea? Okay, next.
The mind, which follows in the wake of the wandering senses, carries away a man's discrimination just as strong wind tosses a boat on the high seas.
It's clear enough? What does it mean to you?
If it's following the wandering senses, then it's taking away that feeling he had of having to kill his family and that sort of thing, right?
Like, right.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, what it's saying is that your discriminative wisdom is going to be completely clobbered by the five senses, because they are running around, they are running after the objects. If I like this cup of coffee, and if I'm not supposed to have it, your discriminative wisdom is saying, or trying to say, don't have it because it's not good for you. But if the mind is uncontrolled, it's good to have it anyway. You have your piece of cake, you have, you know, a glass of wine, which maybe you're supposed to or not supposed to have. But we are driven by the five senses. And that's what it is saying, that, you know, we are tossed around by this lower mind, as they call it, or the ego-based mind, just like a boat is tossed around by wind in a river or in an ocean. That's all it is saying. Okay, next one.
Relinquishing egotism, violence, and self-centered arrogance, abandoning craving, anger, and the selfish power of possessiveness, unselfish and resting in the peace of the Supreme Vision, such a person is fit for oneness with Brahman.
So it's giving you kind of a tip on how to attain that oneness with your pure self-consciousness. Very simple and yet very powerful words here. Get rid of egotism. Get rid of your ego. That's the main culprit in our entire discussion. We've always said that ego is the main culprit. And violence, get rid of violence at any level. We do violence at three levels, right? Physical, mental, and speech level. That's, we talked about that during Sutra discussion also. Violence happens at three levels. Physical violence, mental violence, and speech violence. Okay? And then self-centered arrogance. Again, ego. Oh, I am so-and-so. Who the hell are you? That's arrogance. Craving. You know, even in Buddhism, they say craving is the ultimate source of suffering. Everyone heard that? When you talk of Buddhism, they always say craving for stuff, for the five, you know, for the objects of five senses, that's the root cause of all suffering. The same statement in Gita, same statement in the Yoga Sutras. Okay? Desire and craving. And etc. So we'll keep talking about these things. Ultimately, no selfishness, totally unselfish action. That's what will lead you to become one with the ultimate reality. Okay? What is Bhakti Yoga? I'm going to run out of time. Next one.
Devotion. I believe. Is it?
I'm sorry. Four types of virtuous ones worship or seek me. O Arjuna, they are the distressed, the seeker of self-knowledge, the seeker of wealth, and the enlightened one who has experienced the Supreme Being.
So, who are the, you know, these are the categories of bhakta. Bhakta is a devoted person, the person who is devoted to the Lord, he is called a bhakta. Bhakta. And what he does is bhakti. Bhakti is devotion. And the one who is devoted is called a bhakta. Okay? So what the Lord is saying here is that there are four kinds of bhaktas. One who is distressed. Distressed means you've lost somebody in your life, you know, or you've lost your $1 million in the lottery, or in the stock market. You are distressed. Your car got burnt, you got stolen, things like that. They are the people who come to me, you know. Then you go to a temple, you go to a, you know, to the priest, please help me, you know. That's the distressed person. But then there are others who are seekers of self-knowledge. People like us, you know, we are in the field of yoga and field of spirituality, and we're kind of seeking to understand what my true nature is. They're the second type of person who will do devotion and surrender to God. The third is the true seeker of wealth, people who are really gung-ho on attaining wealth of all kind, material wealth predominantly. Okay, so those are the other people who come to me, because they, oh my God, please God help me attain this wealth, that wealth, and etc., etc. So those are the other bhaktas. And then there are, of course, people who are truly, who have already attained a certain level of spiritual enlightenment. They are truly the real bhaktas, the real devotees. Okay? So that's what this whole thing means. Four categories of people who are devoted to me. Okay, next one.
I personally take care of both the spiritual and material welfare of those ever steadfast devotees who always remember and adore me with single-minded contemplation.
Always talking about single-minded contemplation on me. That's the statement Krishna uses almost in every chapter, many, many places. Go back to me. I am the Supreme Consciousness. I am the God. Surrender yourself to God and then do everything. You'll be okay. All right. Next one.
Whosoever offers me a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water with devotion, I accept the offering of devotion by the pure-hearted.
So it doesn't matter what you offer. What he's saying is, it's a devotion that matters, whether you offer a water to me or a leaf or a flower. You know, that's what people do in the temple. They offer all these things to these statuettes and statues of God. What he's saying is, it doesn't matter. You just have to have that utmost devotion in you. It doesn't matter what you offer.
Arjuna, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer in sacrifice, whatever you give away, whatever you do by way of penance, offer it all to me.
That's the ultimate devotion. You know, that's the, you can say, the final statement of devotion, that no matter what you do, you're not doing it because of your ego. You're doing it as a sacrifice to the source. Okay? So every action that you're doing is a sacrifice to the source. Source is the ultimate pure consciousness, God, basically. And Krishna represents that God in this Bhagavad Gita. Alright? So he's saying, just offer it to me. You believe, you think that you're, everything that you're doing is offering to me, ultimately. Because you're not the doer. Therefore, you're not getting the results of what you get. You offer everything back to me. What you're doing is you're doing as an instrument from me. You are the medium, but I'm the source of your actions. Because I'm driving your actions. Pure intellect. Pure, not the ego. Pure intellect. That's driven by the God. And what you get out of your action, you offer it back to the God. You say, okay, here is what I get. It's all for you, nothing for me. Because I'm not attached to anything anyway. That's the whole concept here.
So how do you offer it? So let's say, whatever you do, right? I go to work in the day.
Right.
I do my job.
Right.
How do I offer that to...
So what you're saying is that, look, I'm doing my job. It's what is the, why am I doing this job, first of all? Because I am getting that inspiration through my intellect, from my pure intuition, which is representation of God. Okay, so I am doing it because I'm inspired by God. Now, and what I'm doing, whatever action I'm doing, it's basically, again, not to fulfill my own desires, but it is to fulfill the original intent of God, who inspired me to do it anyway. Therefore, I'm offering it back to Him. So everything that I'm doing is a fulfillment of a higher intention, which was driven by the God, by that Supreme Consciousness.
So by offering it, I mean, there's, you know, to me, I acknowledge that, you know, the connection that you mentioned, you know, that it's driven by God, it's not really necessarily me doing it. It's like something good as an outcome, you know, my project goes well, but it's not really me, it's the people I work with, it's the environment,
yes,
you know,
yes,
divine inspiration, all those things, right?
Yes.
So, in a way, that's kind of an offering, right? Because I acknowledge that it's not really me.
So, right.
Is there other offering, like, you know, take my money that I get from that and also give it? Is it
that's again a part of offering, yeah. Get the money that you get and then offer it as a charity or give it back for some good cause, etc. All that is offering, basically.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, next one.
Is that me? Mm-hmm. One who remains the same towards friends or foe, in honor or disgrace, in heat or cold, in pleasure or pain, who is free from attachment, who is indifferent to censure or praise, who is quiet and content with whatever one has, unattached to a place, a country, or a house, who is tranquil and full of devotion, that person is dear to me.
It's a lot of words here, but very meaningful, and people spend many, many lectures on just covering these. You know, if you listen to somebody giving a talk, they'll spend several talks on just these concepts, because they have to be applied to life. Now, we're going to run out of time. That's the problem I have. And do you have any leeway at all? 5 minutes extra here or there? Or no, you have to?
5 minutes.
Hmm? 5 to 7 minutes? Okay. Because like I said, you know, these things, these concepts, every one of them, they will require some time to grasp and how to implement them into your life. Okay? Same towards friend and foe. You know, they're easier said than done, as they say. But you have to really think through them and then go with them. Now, this is the meditation part or dhyana yoga. Okay, so we'll go through with them rather quickly. Just read through them.
One must elevate and not denigrate oneself by one's own mind. The mind alone is one's friend if you control it, as well as one's enemy.
Well, it's obviously right. If mind is one's friend or enemy, depending on which mind you're talking about. If you let yourself be controlled by the ego mind, then it's an enemy because it's going to make you do wrong things. But it's the pure intellect, the intuitive mind, then it's the friend. It's going to do the right thing. Okay?
This yoga is not possible for one who eats too much or who does not eat at all, who sleeps too much or too little.
Middle path, basically. Follow the middle path. Don't go to extremes. Okay?
Wherever this restless and unsteady mind wanders during meditation, one should just witness it under the supervision and control of the self.
That's a guideline how to meditate. You know, mind is going to wander around, but acknowledging that, mind is going to wander around, but through the pure intellect, try to bring it back into the oneness, into that concentration. Yeah, it's guideline on meditation itself. Okay?
The best yogi is one who regards every being like oneself and who feels the pain and pleasures of others as one's own.
Right. This is compassion and empathy and all that, which was also mentioned in the Yoga Sutras. We talked about that sutra there, which talked about compassion and empathy, and that is very important because that really gives you a feel, you know, for how the others feel, and then, you know, you can do the right thing. Okay? Go ahead.
Undoubtedly, the mind is restless and difficult to restrain, but it is subdued by any constant, vigorous spiritual practice, such as meditation and perseverance by detachment.
Abhyasa and vairagya. Remember those two? Practice and detachment. They mention exactly the same words in Sanskrit. He uses the same words here. The mind is very difficult to control. Just like Yoga Sutra said, mind is very difficult to control. But how do you control it? Practice. Practice what? In this case, meditation. But in the Yoga Sutra, it's 8 limbs of yoga, of which meditation is the most important practice anyway. And detachment. Detachment, in the Yoga Sutra also we said detachment is the most important part. Okay? Let's go on. Again, the same thing. Me, me, me. Me means God, Supreme Consciousness. Just completely turn yourself to me. Don't think of anything else. I'll take care of everything. Okay? All right. I think we have already kind of covered this. Gunas also we have kind of covered. I don't want to spend too much time on the gunas. Sattva guna. Purity. What it says is, if you read very quickly, if you read these statements here, the gunas are psycho-physical energy threads that constitute material existence. These are the threads of reality that bind us to the world of change. They bind us. These three gunas, they are binding. How do they bind? Sattva is pure, illuminating and free from sickness. It binds the soul through attachment with happiness and knowledge. So even though we are sattvic, even though we are following sattva, which is the most important, we are still bound to its results, attachment to being happy, attachment to being good. And so that's why I said, you know, eventually you have to transcend even the three gunas to become self-realized. As long as you're bound by the gunas, no self-realization. Okay? Alright. So you want to keep reading quickly? Go for number 4 bullet.
It's me. So the top?
No, number 4 bullet. Start. I read the number 3.
Oh, number 4. So Rajas is full of passion and born out of intense desire and attachment. It binds the soul through attachment with action.
So it still binds the soul. The whole idea is to eventually relieve the soul from all bondage. Okay? So this is binding now. Next one.
Tamas is the darkness and the crudeness in man. It is born of ignorance and cause delusion. It binds the soul through recklessness, laziness, and sleep.
So that's all negative tendencies. That's tamas. It binds us through these laziness and sleep and negative stuff. Okay?
One who has transcended the gunas is alike in pleasure and pain, remaining the same towards a piece of gold or a lump of clay, towards the desirable and the undesirable, equal in defamation and self-adulation.
So you have to transcend the three gunas to get to these qualities of being totally equal to defamation or self-adulation or loss and gain, etc., etc. As long as you are driven by the three gunas, you can never get to that state. That's the statement here.
In honor and dishonor, saying to friends and foes, without any egoistic effort in performing actions, he rises above the gunas.
Okay. So how do you go past the gunas? You get through these qualities of being completely the same to friends and foes, honor and dishonor, etc., etc. Okay. I'm just rushing through them because now this is again based on my own kind of understanding. You know, we always ask the question, thousands and thousands of people were killed. It was a violent, violent war. Was it all justified? You know, how do you justify war? I mean, we always say war and peace, war versus peace, and war is never good. But is there a justification for war? And these are my thoughts based on my reading of the Gita multiple times. You know, the preconditions that I thought for engaging in battle, then Arjuna should develop equanimity towards pleasure and pain, loss and gain, victory and defeat. This is what Krishna has been saying all along. Evenness of mind, the equanimity of mind, that's very important. As long as you are attached to victory and defeat, to pay pleasure and pain, you should not be attempting war. Okay? Should surrender to all his acts to him or the Supreme God. So renounce, as in the case of a sannyasi or a person who has renounced everything. You have to renounce all your actions in the war itself. Should have his mind dwelling in the pure spiritual self. Okay, not in the material aspect of our being. Should be free of expectations. So no expectation of any outcome from the war. Okay. Should be free of the common obsession of mind. That it's mine, it's yours, you know, all that we should get rid of. Should avoid all feverishness from his being. Okay. And then he should engage in battle. You know, last time also I gave this example that there was a war going on in a battle. There was one of the Sufi, you know, warriors. He was able to. He was in a combat, hand to hand combat, eventually with his enemy, and so he was able to subdue the enemy, and he had a dagger in his hand. This enemy was lying on the ground and he had his foot on his chest. Back there you can see some of these images. Foot on his chest and he was ready to strike the dagger. Right? So this guy has already subdued the enemy. Now, this enemy guy who was already subdued out of disgust and anger, he spits on this guy's face. You know, out of disgust, he's, oh, you so and so, and he spits on him. And his dagger freezes in the air. Now, this guy is already suffering. He says, kill me. Why don't you kill me? I'm already under your control. Guess, you know, what did this guy say? He says, I can't kill you anymore. He says, why? Look, before you spat on my face, I was doing my job, you were doing your duty. I was a warrior, you were a warrior, right? And I was pure, you know, it was its pure duty. And I was going to kill you. Now you spat on my face. You made me angry. My ego is involved now. If I kill you now, I'll be doing murder, not killing as a duty. I do not want to be a murderer. I cannot kill you until my ego goes away, until my anger goes away. Until then, I'm going to stay like this. Because I'm going to do my duty as a warrior, not as a murderer. So that story always reminds me how you want to, you know, get into the war situation. It's come from a Buddhist, some Sufi story actually. How you should engage in war. Okay, other significant verses. Let's just read these two, because this is a very good. Go ahead, read.
Humility, modesty, nonviolence, forgiveness, honesty, service to Guru, purity of thought, word, and deed, steadfastness, self-control, aversion for sense objects, absence of ego, constant reflection on the pain and suffering inherent in birth, old age, disease, and death.
There are 20 qualities mentioned, you know, which make a person a yogi or a person of knowledge, etc. So let's go on and read the next one also.
Detachment with family members, home, etc., unfalling equanimity upon attainment of the desirable and the undesirable, and unswerving devotion to me through single-minded contemplation, taste for solitude, distaste for social gatherings and gossip, steadfastness in acquiring the knowledge of the self and seeing the omnipresent supreme being everywhere. This is said to be knowledge. That which is contrary to this is ignorance.
Okay, so there are 20 of these qualities mentioned. And again, like I said, these people who go through these lectures, they'll spend several days in talking about each one of these qualities, one by one. They take them and then they'll explain to you how what they mean in our life and how to implement them in different situations in life and how to eventually become a person who's a knowledgeable person called jnani. Jnani is a person who knows, okay, he's wise. Okay, so that's the meaning of these verses here. Okay, I'm going to skip these. This is a ladder of destruction. This is very commonly, very, very frequently quoted. So let's go through these two quickly. You want to read that?
One develops attachment to sense objects by thinking about the sense objects. Desire for sense objects comes from attachment to sense objects, and anger comes from unfulfilled desires.
Next one.
Delusion or wild ideas arise from anger. The mind is bewildered by delusion. Reasoning is destroyed when the mind is bewildered. One falls from the right path when reasoning is destroyed.
So this, they call it the ladder of destruction. Finally, because you were attached to the sense objects, and those desires were not met, you became angry. And what anger can do to you is what is mentioned here. It can completely annihilate your reasoning of all kinds of reasoning at all. So anger is the enemy that he is talking about here. The worst enemy possible. And what causes the anger? Attachment to the five senses. It's mentioned in the Gita. And like I said, it is one of the most quoted statements in the Gita, that get rid of anger, absolutely. No situation should make you angry. Because once you get angry, you have lost the reason, you have lost reasoning altogether. You're not able to reason about anything. That means your rationality is gone, you're making completely irrelevant decisions. You cannot make any proper decision when you're angry, so just get rid of that anger. Okay, so that's a very beautiful statement. Chapter 2, it's very nicely done there. And this is just a few things that I was able to pick. I have not read this book, Bhagavad Gita on Effective Leadership, but I read some reviews and they were very nice reviews. I could not get my hands on this book. Then there was a very nice article in Business Week, which I read, Karma Capitalism. And the title was, Has the Bhagavad Gita Replaced the Art of War as the Hip New Ancient Eastern Management Text? It was very nicely written and very beautiful kind of management style kind of a article on Gita. Then there was a guy that I met. His name was Satish Modh. He came to Raleigh at one time many years ago. And he runs a company in India. And he does consulting for all kinds of people, corporate consulting, student consulting, at different levels of consulting, what does he do? He gives out a questionnaire to everybody. There are about 60 questions. And you can go to his website and fill out the questionnaire. Okay, and based on the questionnaire, he will tell you whether you are sattvic, tamasic or rajasic. Which of the three gunas is dominant in you? And then depending on what guna is dominant, he can guide you as to what career path you should take, what kind of a student study you should take. And he does that consulting as a profession. And he's very successful. Anyway, he does it purely based on your guna that's dominant in you, because everyone has a certain balance, certain framework of the gunas, and based on that he will tell you what career path you should take, what you should do in your job, what you should do as a student, what you should do as a husband, as a wife, etc., etc. All levels of consulting.
And is he here or is he?
In India. He lives in Mumbai. Mm-hmm. He runs his company in Mumbai. All right. So you can go to his website and kind of fill out the form and see what it does. All right. Sorry, we got a little late.
Okay.
It's always a struggle to try and fit everything in 2 hours.
Thank you. It was fascinating.
Let's close the eyes. Just do 3 ohms. We always do that. So let's close the eyes. Sit up nice and comfortable, tall. Let's recite Om 3 times. Inhale. We'll join the palms together and recite the word for peace in Sanskrit, which is Shanti, 3 times. I'll do it first and then we'll all do it together. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Together. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Namaste and have a wonderful day. Thank you, Dharma, for giving me this opportunity. As always, it was wonderful.